The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. It's good to see everybody. I ran across this little passage in the koan. Literature that I'd like to start with, as it's kind of a gateway into what I want to talk about today. And it goes like this. Crystal clear on all sides, open and unobstructed in all directions, emanating light, and making the earth tremble in all places, subtly exercising spiritual powers at all times. And then the passage ends with a question, which I'll get to in a moment. Now, I thought this was a lovely description of our mind when we're doing Zazen. And, you know, Zazen can be a rocky road. We're not always, it doesn't always feel great. And so sometimes it's difficult to appreciate what exactly is going on. Crystal clear on all sides. So every time we let go of a thought, there it is, reality. And every time a thought comes up, that's reality. Crystal clear. Nothing hidden or obstructed. Open and unobstructed in all directions. Emanating light and making the world tremble. Well, what is this light that is emanating? It's not a mysterious or esoteric light for sitting on a wooden floor. The wooden floor is light. For facing a white wall, the white wall is light. If we're hearing sawing and jackhammers as we sit, sawing and jackhammers are this wonderful light. No obstruction, nothing hidden. The wonderful mind of Zazen. But then the passage ends with a question. Tell me, how is this manifested? Well, it's no riddle how it's manifested when we're sitting in formal practice like this. It's manifested with our fanny on a cushion, radiating in the 10 directions. But how about off the cushion? Is there such a thing as off the cushion? How is it manifested minute by minute, hour by hour in the lives of us as lay practitioners in the big city? Good question, I think. And as it turns out, the answer, in a way, is it's manifested as compassion. And I say that because this passage is the introduction to a very famous koan about the bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. And it goes like this. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with this figure, which you might have seen in a temple or a souvenir shop, the Avalokiteshvara could be a man, could be a woman, but many, many arms reaching out to help and to heal. And sometimes the figure is portrayed as having an eye in each palm of its many, many hands. Sometimes as having a tool in each one of the many hands. And actually, it kind of comes to the same thing, because the Bodhisattva is holding a wrench, then the wrench is an eye that goes to the bolt that needs to be tightened. If it's a screwdriver, the screwdriver is an eye that goes to the screw. If it's a poem, the poem is an eye that goes to the soul, if it's a good poems. So whether it's a tool or whether it's an eye, the many hands and eyes of Avalokiteshvara always respond appropriately to the suffering of the world. What does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Dao Wu said, it's like someone reaching back for a pillow in the middle of the night. And when we're considering these koans, I think it really helps to sort of connect with the image. So what is it like when someone reaches back for a pillow in the middle of the night? Basically, it's a groping, right? It's pitch dark. You don't know where the pillow is exactly. And the movement is constant. The groping is constant. It's like someone groping for a pillow in the middle of the night. All those hands and eyes are groping in the darkness, not knowing what the right response is, not having a preconceived idea of what the right response is, not having a preconceived idea of what compassion is, or what it looks like. This sort of flexible, ever-moving, unknowing quality our founding Japanese teacher, Dogen, saw as samadhi. In other words, for Dogen, samadhi is not some special state that we do zazen to attain. Samadhi is the direct manifestation of the mind of zazen. Dogen says, samadhi is actualization. It is expression. It is the time of night when a hand is reaching back, groping for a pillow. When the hand reaches back for a pillow at night, this groping is not limited to thousands of millions of eons, but is, I am always in the ocean, expounding the wondrous Lotus Sutra. So what he's referring to here is that the Buddha said, I do not appear in the world, nor do I disappear. I am always in the ocean, expounding the Lotus Sutra, expounding the Sutra of Compassion, expounding the Sutra of responding appropriately according to causes and conditions to heal the suffering of the world. The Lotus Sutra has a lot to say about Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And one of the main teachings of the Lotus Sutra is that this Bodhisattva can appear in many guises, not necessarily so easy to recognize when you're in the presence of a great Bodhisattva, nor are Bodhisattvas always great Bodhisattvas at all times and in all situations. They have their ups and downs like we all do. The Lotus Sutra begins with a question in this passage. The Bodhisattva, inexhaustible intent, said to the Buddha, World Honor One, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, how does she come and go in this world? How does she preach the law for the sake of living beings? How does the power of expedient means apply in this case? And I'm going to kind of gloss over what the Buddha said because it's kind of long, but basically he said, good men, if there are living beings who need to hear the teaching from the body of a Buddha in order to be saved, the Bodhisattva manifests as a Buddha. If living beings need to see a lower order of Buddha, a Pratyeka Buddha, in order to be saved, then the Bodhisattva manifests as a Pratyeka Buddha. If they need a boy or a girl or a wife or a husband in a household in order to be saved, then the Bodhisattva manifests as a wife or a husband or a boy and a girl. And as I think a number of you have experienced, sometimes the Bodhisattva can manifest as a cat or a dog jumping into your lap at just the right time. Bodhisattva has no particular form. In a commentary on the koan, there's a beautiful summary of the flexibility, the multifaceted quality of the Bodhisattva of great compassion. It is like the willow-grown banks and the flower-grown walls on a warm day and a gentle breeze. Where is the spring? What shape is it? Nevertheless, it is able to accord with things and come with the time, unstopped, unhindered, like the moon in the sky, revolving naturally. In springtime, spring has no particular shape or form. But when you look at the budding trees, you see it there. When you look at the rain teeming in the gutter, you see it there. When you hear the birds chirping as the sun comes up, You hear it there. The eyes of the Bodhisattva of the great compassion becomes an ear that hears the birds. So from this it should be clear that when we're talking about Avalokiteshvara, the being of great compassion, we're not talking about something or someone who's separate from ourselves. It should be the easiest thing in the world to be able to manifest the Bodhisattva. And yet, we feel that there's something to attain. We feel that there is something separating us from being the compassionate being that we aspire to be. And, of course, in Buddhism, usually we trace the problem to the old delusion that there's a solid self, that there is an ego. Usually the ego is strongly identified with the babble of thoughts that come up when we sit on our cushions and go, oh yeah, that's me talking inside my head. And so we create this kind of solid, illusory solid thing called me, even though, you know, clearly me is someone different today than he was 60 years ago, quite different, in fact, almost unrecognizable. What happened to that five-year-old me? And yet the sense of me is very strong, and there's nothing wrong with that. We need our individual me's. We need to be able to function in the world and have an identity and have preferences and tastes. There's nothing wrong with that, but we forget that it's not real. We think it's something we have to defend, that we have to guard. And because it is an insubstantial as a phantom, we feel it needs to be gussied up. And we're always trying to gussy it up. Some people try to gussy it up by buying a Porsche or getting a big McMansion or becoming the head of a corporation. And other types of people try to gussy it up by becoming a compassionate being or a good Buddhist or whatever that, whatever your favorite thing happens to be. And as long as we're trying to gussy up this phantom, immediately we feel separate. There's me who has to become a compassionate being. And we miss the fact that we are already the eyes and hands of Avalokiteshvara. There never was any Avalokiteshvara separate from that. We miss the fact that we are the Buddha always in the ocean preaching the Lotus Sutra, unborn and unborn and unextinguished, always in the ocean. So, what's the way out? Well, for Dogen, the way out is practice. He says it is not that there is no practice and enlightenment, it is just that they cannot be divided. But how do we practice? What's the best way to practice? Well, fortunately, we have a wonderful inheritance from our Dharma grandfather, Bernie Glassman, who passed away recently and who will be remembering this afternoon during his service. We have the three tenets of the Zen peacemaker order. And the first one, and I believe the one that Bernie Roshi emphasized above all others, was not knowing, thereby giving up fixed ideas of myself and the universe, giving up the idea of this illusory self that needs to be gussied up all the time, giving up that fixed idea, not knowing. An interviewer once asked Bernie, why are you always attracted to places of great suffering? The inner city, Auschwitz, why are you always going to these kind of awful places? And Bernie said, I don't know. Just like Bodhidharma, right? I don't know. And he said, and I love this, he says, the words that come to me, I hang out there because I desire to learn. Not I desire to help. I desire to be a great bodhisattva and admired because I'm a wonderful saint. I come there because I don't know, and I come there to learn. He says, it happens a lot to me when I encounter a situation I don't understand. It generally involves suffering. When I enter a situation that is too much for me and that I don't understand, I have a desire to sit there, to stay a while. There's a magnet that pulls me so that I want to stay there. I haven't figured it out. Not knowing, giving up fixed ideas of myself and the universe. And the interviewer went on and asked him, well, why is not knowing, why do you place such emphasis on not knowing? Why is not knowing so important to your teaching? And Bernie said, unknowing was emphasized by my teacher, my Zumi Roshi, and it fits my temperament. It just makes so much sense to start from unknowing. At every moment, one starts from unknowing so that all the acquired knowledge will arise spontaneously and be used in a new creative way. This was a man who had a PhD in applied mathematics from a major university and who had made himself an expert in organizational structure and culture, business. This was a man who had the kind of mind that could not leave the world alone and had to insatiable curiosity, was a great scholar in many fields. And yet, it's all just dead words, dead knowledge, unless you let it all go and allow it to arise spontaneously in the midst of unknowing and be used in a new creative way unless you're willing to grope for the pillow in the dark. Not resting, just keep groping. What next? What next? Where does the eye want to travel to heal my own suffering and that of others? So, quite naturally, out of the tenet of not knowing comes the tenet of bearing witness. As he said, just not trying to make or be anything, but just to hang out, to sit quietly in the midst of the flames of the suffering of the world, to be Avalokiteshvara and hear the cries of the world, whether you hear them literally through the ears or you see them through the eyes and your eyes become ears that hear the cries of the world, your thoughts, your guts, just to wholeheartedly bear witness in the midst of the flames of suffering. This is the precept of practicing good. And then finally, the third tenet, healing myself and others. Somehow, if we're willing not to know, and we're willing to bear witness, there's an eye in our groping hands. And, oh, yeah, maybe I should do that. Maybe, you know, we need housing for these Zen students in Los Angeles. Maybe I should buy, you know, we should invest in the slums around here and provide housing. And the next thing you know, there's a Zen center that's as large as a city block in the heart of Los Angeles. Well, we need to support our little Zen group in Yonkers. Well, yeah, like, okay, so we could have a little bakery and sell some stuff and raise money for the Sangha. Okay, we're doing that. But wait, you know, I see that there's a lot of homelessness here in Yonkers. We could give people jobs in this bakery. We could train them to be workers. We could teach them how to work and support themselves. And the next thing you know, that little Zen student bakery becomes a social enterprise, providing jobs, training, a living wage to dozens and I think ultimately maybe even hundreds of people in some of the most depressed areas of Westchester County. Oh wait, they need a place to their kids, you know, when they're working at the bakery, their kids need a place. They need a place to dump their kids. All of a sudden, childcare facilities open up. Was this part of a master plan? Was this part of someone saying, oh, I'm a great compassionate being and I'm going to straighten out Yonkers? No, this was the result of a man who was willing not to know, to bear witness, and to follow his intention of healing himself and others wherever it might lead. I'd like to conclude with a wonderful little mondo from the Book of Serenity that involves Fa Yan and Dizong, his teacher. And Fa Yan had completed his studies and he was putting on his sandals and getting ready to walk off the reservation. And Dizong said, the teacher said, "Where are you going?" And Fa Yan said, "I'm going to walk around on a pilgrimage." Dizong said, "What is the purpose of your pilgrimage?" Fa Yan said, "I don't know." Dizong deeply approved and said, "Not knowing is most intimate."